UFP, the United Federation of Podcasts.
Welcome to Franchise Fatigue, the little podcast on the United Federation of Podcast Network, where your hosts go through movies, remakes, and sequels, and we analyze them for you. I'm your host, Brandon Shea Mutella, and joining me, like I would say as always, like he looks like the guy that I podcasted with last time, but I think he's a completely different character this time, and now he's got a kid with him. I mean, he's still flying something, but it's not a chopper. I don't know what's going on here. Who are you?
That's a great question. That has to be some of the most confusing casting. I literally had to go look this up online. I was like, is this supposed to be the same guy? Because I was like angry that it was a continuity mistake because they had established that Bruce Spence's character from the second film had gone and become the leader of that other. I'm like, man, what are you just ignoring your continuity? What are you, Star Trek Discovery? But then I was like, oh, he's a different character.
Is he, though? Like, because he could have had this kid with the blonde woman.
He's the Jeffrey Combs of Mad Max.
Maybe he is. I don't know.
But that
Anyways,
is odd.
Who are you, though? Who are you?
I'm Zach. How's it going?
Hey, Zach. You know what, though? I know it wasn't the same guy because his teeth were better.
And he looked, although this movie apparently takes place 15 years later, he looks about 15 years younger than he did in the last one. Does he? Was it just me?
Interesting. Bizarre. Anywho, welcome to our discussion on Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. We're looking forward to continuing on with our discussion on the Mad Max franchise. But Zach, I just want to interrupt you first here and just let you know, okay, look, I want you to be calm here on this discussion. Don't go off the rails, okay? We don't need another hero.
That's right. We don't need another hero. Are you a Tina Turner fan, Brandon? Are you familiar with her body of work?
There's some body of work of hers that I'm familiar with. Yes, that's for sure.
Very good.
I confess to you, man, ever since I was a young kid, I've been in love with Tina Turner.
Okay, fair.
I love Tina Turner. Her Private Dancer album is like one of the greatest albums of all time. And I was a huge Tina Turner fan. And this movie might have been part of the reason for it. You know, like
I think that probably was a factor.
Yeah. But my mom had Private Dancer on vinyl and we listened to it all the time. And I mean, it was one of the first CDs that I bought was Private Dancer. So, yeah. So, you know what? There might be a little bit of Tina Turner colored glasses that I looked through that I watched this movie through.
Yeah, you know, I'm sure that people would look at that and say, I mean, it was to it like stunt casting to an extent, but I'm like, I don't mind it. And hey, Goldeneye, right? Just a few years later, she does the James Bond song Goldeneye as well. So,
which is one of my favorite James Bond theme songs.
It really, yeah.
I love that song so
Same.
Much. It is so good.
Same. So 80s and 90s, man. Tina Turner, top of the world. And so this is, of all the Mad Max movies, is the one I remember the most and are the most fond of. So it's interesting because I hadn't seen it in a while. And then I'm like, oh, well, the public reception is, this is like the worst one. But I'm like, I disagree. But that's what we're here to talk about.
Oh, so. that'll be interesting to talk about. So I love this movie, but this is probably the bottom of the four. I mean, like, to be fair, I mean, like, that's, in my opinion, this is a very good movie to be putting on the bottom. But I mean, we can definitely go through our lists. And
we will hash it out.
We will hash it out. We'll hash it out in the Thunderdome.
Yeah, two podcasters enter. One podcaster leaves.
Oh, we should have started with that. That's so good. Let's start again. Anywho, awesome. Well, let's discuss this. Let's talk about some Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. What do you got for some trivia here, buddy?
Yeah, so this was originally not going to be a Mad Max film. As I mentioned in the trivia for Mad Max 2, a.k.a. The Road Warrior, that was going to be the end of Mad Max. But George Miller was working on this post-apocalyptic Lord of the Flies-style movie about a group of children who were found by an adult, and they just turned that adult into Mad Max. And so that fit perfectly for what they were going for. I mean, yeah, post-apocalypse, just go with the franchise you already have going on, George Miller, right? So he was actually, George Miller was actually just going to produce, and then George Ogilvie, I don't know if I'm saying his name right or not, was going to direct. Now, he had only directed a couple of television miniseries before this, but eventually both Georges directed the film together, and that's why the credit is credited as George Miller and George Ogilvie. I'm going to keep just saying
Ogilvie.
His name real fast.
Ogilvie, isn't it?
Ogilvie, okay.
Ogilvie. Mm-hmm.
George Ogilvie. Mm-hmm. Now, not only are both their names George, but they both have twin brothers as well, which is a weird
really
factoid for you at parties. You can throw that out there. Now, there was a misconception that originally George Miller had just agreed to direct the action sequences and George Ogilvie was directing the rest of the film, but this was debunked by George Miller. The only time where they weren't together filming is when Ogilvie was filming the camel sequences. But besides that, they were both on set together, much like the Russo brothers and the Marvel Cinematic Universe direct movies together, or the Wachowskis from The Matrix, right? So it's not that uncommon of an idea to have two directors like that. But basically, George Miller wanted to make it clear it wasn't like a first unit, second unit deal. They directed this film together. So, Now, George Miller, he was given the rights to Mad Max 2 and Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome because he was attached to direct Contact, the 1997 movie with Matthew McConaughey and Jodie Foster. And the studio wanted him to step aside from that. So as a barter town here, they said, you can have the rights to these Mad Max movies, but you needed to step off of directing Contact. Now, I don't even know what that whole situation was. I have to look into that. Like, why did they want to replace him? I'm not sure. But he got a good end of the deal, and he has the rights to these Mad Max sequels. So good on you, George.
So he gets all the profits from these? Is that what that means?
I'm not sure, right? I mean, because there's the whole marketing, there's the merchandising. I mean, it's not like Mad Max some crazy merchandising juggernaut, but it's kind of like a George Lucas deal with Star Wars, right? Like Fox had Star Wars, but George Lucas had complete control of Empire Strikes Back or Return of the Jedi. So I'm thinking it's something like that.
Okay.
But I had no idea that he was attached to Contact at all. Like that's very interesting.
Well, Contact was in production for a long time. Like, they were trying to make that for a really long time, as far as I remember. I think Zemeckis finally directed that film.
Yeah, Robert Zemeckis. Yeah.
But, like, that's crazy. Like, look, dude, we do not want you to make this movie. Get off the movie, and here's what you get instead.
Here, like, just take these rights to these other movies you made and get out of our lives. because Contact was 97, right? So that's 12 years after this film. So, anyway. Speaking of time periods, Beyond Thunderdome takes place 15 years after Mad Max 2, which took place 5 years after Mad Max, which makes this film 20 years after the first film. We spanned two decades of this man's life over the course of, six real world years. So, but couldn't you tell because he had longer hair and some gray in it? So he looked 20 years older.
He looked older. So since Mad Max takes place in the present day, so this is 2041?
It's a few years from now, is all I can say.
Oh, that's right, a few years from now. So 2045, 2045, yeah. Okay, gotcha.
This takes place after Skynet has been defeated and the nuclear war in Planet of the Apes has been going on as well.
Okay.
So Max, right? His name is only mentioned once when he shows up and Master Blaster asks him who he is. He's like, me, Max. And he's funny because that's how Master Blaster talks. He's like, who you? You fix and me, Max. So he responds that way and that's it. There's not any random name drops like there were in the last film. Like, you're supposed to, come on, Max, what's your deal, man? Like, I didn't tell you my name. And he's never called the Reward Warrior either. So he's just the, what does Tina Turner call him? A Raggedy Man?
Raggedy Man.
Yeah. That's what he'd be credited as. He's also called, Brandon, the man with no name in this. He's introduced into Thunderdome. So that's the thing that's pretty cool. Leaning into the Western Clint Eastwood influences, I think.
Well, I think that Raggedy Man Beyond Thunderdome would not be a good movie that people would go and see. I don't think that would get a lot of people coming in.
No, they should call it The Road Warrior Beyond Thunderdome. A Mad Max story. But now, 20 years later, right? So Mad Max, he's accumulated some injuries, apparently. And this is hard to see in the film unless you're watching it on a big screen in HD. Of course, this is something you'd never recognize back in the VHS days that we were watching these. But one of his pupils is permanently dilated. So this is probably a nod to Mad Max 2 when Wes, who was the main henchman of that film, forces his car off the road and that kind of thing. That is where the headcanon fan theory as of why his injuries would have come from that particular injury. And you can see it most in the shot where he first sees the Thunderdome, and it's kind of a low angle shot. You zoom into Max's face. That's where you can see it the most.
I never noticed.
Yeah, I didn't either, but I'm sure if you freeze frame your what do you have this on HD DVD or
Blu-ray, believe it or not, I have this on Blu-ray.
Well, there you go. We'll freeze frame your way through and catalog all of his injuries. Now, this was the first film of the franchise with financing from the United States, which was why it's more, you know, mainstream. That explains why Tina Turner is involved. And the part of Aunt Entity, who's, by the way,
Entity
is never said in the movie. She's just Anti. So that's one of those characters. It's like Boba Fett. Just call him Bounty Hunter. Nobody says Boba Fett in Empire Strikes Back. Say it in Return of the Jedi real quick. But anyway, they're not into naming characters, you know, speaking their names on the film, in the movies. But this part was specifically written for Tina Turner before she'd even been approached about appearing in the film. So I thought that was pretty interesting.
Oh, wow.
It's kind of like when they wrote Star Trek II with Khan in it. They're like, hey, has anybody asked Ricardo Montalban if he wants to be in this? But anyway, she accepted, of course, and she was all about it. She had to shave her head for that wig to fit properly, but she had no problem with that. And that steel like chainmail dress that she wears weighed 121 pounds.
Whoa.
Which is 55 kilograms for you up there in Canada, Brandon.
That's crazy. Like, she's a pretty, you know, kind of a thin woman. Like, she's pretty small. Like, that's, she probably will only weigh 120 pounds.
Right, she probably weighs as much as her. But, you know, she's fit, so she can handle it. At the end of the car chase, because you know there had to be a car chase, because it's a Mad Max movie, right? Everybody had to drive a vehicle, and they're all built. All these vehicles are built using manual manual transmissions, but Tina Turner couldn't drive a manual transmission, so they had to equip the car that she drove with an automatic transmission.
Well, the only thing about that chase at the end that I'm really disappointed with is when the train didn't, like, jump off the tracks and fly away.
And I thought it was going to reach the end and just have flames behind it, and they were going to go off to Tomorrow Marland.
Really disappointed with that, yeah.
If only they had paid George Miller to get off this film so Robert Zemeckis could direct this third film of this trilogy.
Right?
Right? It's ridiculous how these are all connected like this. But
that's why Zemeckis wanted him off. They're like, because you didn't make it a time-traveling train.
Because this film, I mean, especially watching on Blu-ray, it looks like it was filmed yesterday. So it looks fantastic image-wise. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking to myself, what year was this now? Why are they ripping off Back to the Future 3? I'm like, oh, 1985. Back to the Future 3 ripped off this. So I thought that was just interesting. And this is the final film of Angelo Rosito. He was the little man, Master Blaster. He had a career lasting 60 years, and this was his final film. And this was a lot of the kids. I'm going to call them like the Lost Boys, or I don't know what else to call them, right? There's a lot of their first acting gigs, obviously. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The casting director scoured Australian schools. And then they went from 20 months old to 16 years old as the age range of these kids. And Helen Boudet is probably the most famous actress who was one of these kids. And she was the one that Mad Max punches in the face. I was like, you know, this film's a little lighter in some areas, but it's actually darker in other areas. So I was like, hey, surely he's not going to. Oh, he did. Just punch her in the face. So now, it wasn't just a lot of kids in this movie. It was a lot of pigs, which maybe foreshadowed George Miller's involvement in the Babe franchise. Maybe he got an affinity for pigs working on this film. There was 600 pigs in the underworld where the methane, you know, this film is very educational. Teach you about gasoline and methane and all that, right? If they bought that many pigs, it could have influenced and impacted the pork market of the world in a negative way. So what they did was they just rented them all from a pig farmer. So,
okay.
Speaking of animals, right? Mad Max is a monkey this time, not a dog. What'd you think of that?
I thought it reminded me of Raiders of the Lost Ark,
which came out 4 years before this. But monkeys are a pretty common sidekick. You know, even Ace Ventura has a monkey sidekick in one of his movies. So, but anyway.
Yeah, dog. 15 years later, dog wouldn't have been around
That's
anymore.
That's true. Dog wouldn't have been around. I was like, there were points in the movie, I'm like, what happened to the monkey? Because especially when he gives him the water, and then you don't see him, and then he passes out. I'm like, where's the monkey? But then I'm like, oh, he's in his coat or something. So anyway, I was worried about the monkey, but you did see him escape.
He ate him.
He ate the monkey. It's terrible. So all these kids, right, they spent 2 months in workshops learning to hunt, climb, and use primitive weapons. So they were like qualified to be this tribe of kids of the adventure. So I thought that was pretty cool. Because, okay, have you seen Hook?
It's been a long time, but I've seen it once or twice.
Like,
yeah.
And I was thinking to myself, what are they ripping off Hook? Again, I'm like, no, Hook came out Hook 6 years out after this. But I've rewatched and I'm more familiar with Hook than I am with this film. So I'm like, this is what I'm thinking of the whole time, the tribe of kids and stuff. And, but it's funny because again, like looking at how new it looks, a lot of movies, I can instantly tell you what year they came out. Right. But mm-hmm. others, I'm like, I don't know, like late 80s, early 90s, that would have been this, but mm-hmm. no, 1985 predates all this stuff that I think that it's referencing.
You think about, yeah.
So Steven Spielberg, you sir, ripped off Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, but.
See, I keep thinking that this came out in 87 for some reason, but yeah, 85. Hey.
87, RoboCop, Predator, yeah, Jaws
seems
of
like
Revenge.
That kind of year, you know?
Speaking of continuity from the other films, we're talking about Mad Max's appearance earlier. When he's giving over a lot of his weapons, you see a lot of the weapons he had in the previous film. His sawed-off shotgun is a little different, and this film has exposed hammers in a different grip, but it's been 15 years, so maybe he customized it or had a different one. He also pulls out a crossbow, which would have been mm-hmm. Wes's weapon from Mad Max 2. Presumably he took it off his body and at the end of the film. So I thought it was just pretty cool just to see. Again, this franchise is very loose with the continuity as far as like timeline and props and characters, for example, as mm-hmm. we were joking about at the beginning. But it's cool just to have those little nods in there because you could see this film and not need the other films, right? Mm-hmm. But that just kind of, if you know what you're looking for, like, oh, that's cool. That might have been so-and-so's weapon from the last film.
Yeah, because as I was saying before, I think this was the first one that I saw, right? And I enjoyed it without having seen the other two.
Right. So we see the Atomic Cafe in Bartertown, and that is a reference to a 1982 movie called The Atomic Cafe. And that was part of the inspiration, George Miller's inspiration for this film. So we wanted to just have a little nod to it right there. And if this is a post, I don't know, if this is a post-apocalyptic world where there were atomic bombs, would you want to go to the Atomic Cafe?
Probably some good coffee.
Radioactive coffee.
Radioactive coffee.
What's a little fallout, mate?
Oh, yeah, that party. Drink this water. Oh,
like how he has the, Lord. The Geiger counter or whatever. First, I was like, what is that sound? Oh, it's coming from the movie. It was the Geiger counter. Now, the little whistle that Mad Max uses to disable Blaster, that is a sailor's boatswain's pipe, and it's still used on Navy ships today.
And on the Enterprise to announce the Admiral.
Attention.
Yeah. They just have an electronic one.
That's right, because it's the future. Now, the stunt involving the train hitting the car with Iron Bar, that was the Wes of this movie. There are a lot of things. I'm like, okay, you guys just kind of redid the things from last week, but that's fine. Even his look and everything, the feathers and his being bald. But that was performed by Dennis Williams, who was the same stuntman who did the Mack truck stunt in The Road Warrior, well, the last film, Mad Max 2. It did not go exactly as planned from the beginning. Originally, the train had to be backed up to make way for an actual train using that same railway line, and the stunt was rescheduled for the next day. And then after crashing into the car, the stunt driver sustained burns on his left arm and shoulder and had to go to the hospital. So not quite as successful as the Mack truck from mm-hmm. Mad Max 2. Now, the sandstorm at the end of the film, that was real. And a camera plane flew into it for some shots, and the storm itself hit the crew in the desert, and it forced them to ride it out in their cars or wherever they could find cover. So, to quote Star Wars Episode One, sandstorms are very, very dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Or to quote Super 8, production value.
Yes. There you go. There are a couple of scenes that were cut from the film. It is said it was for running time, not necessarily concept-wise, but we'll see. What you think, Brandon? There were two scenes now. First would have been Max dreaming about his murdered wife and son, and he wakes up and cries, and it's like the self-realization moment that he's become just as bad as the people who murdered his family and the people he used to hunt as a cop. So that's, I don't know if you could really communicate that. That would have been very stock footage of the first film again. I kind of like how this one stands on its own, so I don't know. I understand they want to keep that through line here, but the other one would have been Max takes a gecko on top of a sand dune at night, and he sees the lights of Bartertown, and he tells this gecko that they've reached Tomorrow Maraland. And apparently a few seconds of that are included in Tina Turner's We Don't Need Another Hero music video. So,
ooh, Okay.
You should go look that one up, Brandon, being such a Tina Turner fan, and see if you see that. But
yeah, find that on YouTube. I think that that's probably good that those were cut. I mean, like the what you said about the through line with the wife and whatnot, I don't think it's really necessary, and I don't think that would have been conveyed, because even here, I don't get the impression that Max is as bad as the guys from the first film, like watching this film, right?
Right.
So I wouldn't have caught that if that's what they're trying to do, unless he like said it. But even if he would have said it, I would have been like, well, no, he's not.
Yeah.
So, because, like, look at him in Thunderdome, right? He doesn't want to kill Blaster.
Right, right. No, I think that's a huge insight into who he is still, despite, you know, everything he's gone through. And, you know, that's something that might be better off. And I think it's in the novelization of the film. So I think that might be better, something to explore there, where you're kind of in a character's head. But just visually there, you're like, well, that feels odd. And I'm glad we've kind of moved past, because the second film was like, okay, we got to like go back around and retcon this first film being into this film kind of thing, and some stock footage. But now, like, okay, we're 100% in this world now. We don't need to worry about that. So moving on from that, I think it was a smart thing.
Mm-hmm.
Co-screenwriter Terry Hayes had said they had considered killing off Max to end the trilogy. But then they changed their mind. They said, you know what, we're gonna end this with him regaining his humanity and walking off into the sunset, so to speak. Because he, you know, through his experiences with the kids and stuff, he's more of a, you know, full person again, I guess. Because I mean, we talked about the last one, he has like what, 16 lines or something, I think it was, right? This, I actually enjoy how he has more dialogue interactions with people. He's more human than he was, you know, than just the mythical road warrior guy. So, and I think that would have been a fine ending, you know. I mean, it's still left ambiguous. He kind of walks off into the desert, and again, like the last film, it's like the people he's helped telling the story at the narration at the end, and he's just a figure in their history and their story. So I think that would have been a fine way to end it. And in a way, it kind of is, because this is the end of Mel Gibson's turn as the character.
Right. Had they decided to kill him, though, I think the only acceptable way would have been if he realized that he needed to commit suicide, because he had inside of him a queen anti-entity, right? And so he just would jump off into the lava pit and die.
And then he'll come back as a clone in the next movie. But anyway. Now, this is the only film so far, right? There are more to come, presumably down the road in Mad Max, but this is the only film in the franchise so far that has a PG-13 rating. And George Miller decided to tone down the violence due to the nature of the story and, you know, the kids and all that. And so I think it works. It doesn't bother me the same way that you see like RoboCop or Terminator turn PG-13. I think there's still enough here where that doesn't hurt the film. What do you think?
I agree, because even rewatching it, like, I don't think that the other two are pretty violent, like bloody and whatnot. Like, we talked about that a bit, where the violence isn't that bad in the other two. Maybe it's just desensitization over the years or whatnot. But like, even in the first one, all they show is the guy's bloody hand. You know, there's a lot of implication, but they don't really show a lot. I don't know. Maybe I'm just warped. I don't know.
Yeah.
They show some boobs in the second one, right? And they show some naked in the first one.
Yeah, we need more of that. That's what we're missing. So.
Missing the TNA.
Yeah. Now, Thunderdome, right? The fights here, this inspired professional wrestler Dusty Rhodes to create a new wrestling match called War Games. And that premiered in 1987. And then it was at the WCW, the World Championship Wrestling, from 1993 to 2000. And then it didn't come back again until 2017 by the WWE, the World Wrestling Entertainment. And so it's been reintroduced on an annual basis from there. And obviously it's not like killing people or weapons and stuff, but it's kind of a whole cage match kind of thing. And I think that's pretty cool. And that was, but wrestling was big back then. It makes sense that these kind of found each other. And even the way that these guys dress is very much like professional wrestlers in a way, so I can definitely see the connection between this and wrestling.
Does that War Games at least have them on those big rubber things that are bouncing around the cage?
You know, I hope so. I've never seen it. I'll have to go look it up after this. I've never been the biggest wrestling guy. I mean, I've played wrestling video games and stuff, and of course know some of the big names, but if they're not on those rubber band things, then what is the point? Like, that's part of the appeal of Thunderdome.
Exactly.
Now, the song you mentioned, Brandon, We Don't Need Another Hero, reached number 2 on the US charts and number 3 on the UK charts and number 1 on the Australia charts in summer of 1985. Makes sense. Australia, that's kind of Mad Max and their guys. So went out there and supported his song. And then later on in 1996, the music video for California Love by Tupac was shot in a Thunderdome set and featured vehicles and costumes inspired by Mad Max. So even then, it had a pop culture.
We're covering that music video for this franchise.
We're going to cover these. Yes, we're now covering music video tie-ins to these films. But as, you know, I think that speaks to like the cultural impact, because Thunderdome, right? I mean, everybody knows what that is, and I think it's it's a common phrase, and two enter, one leave. That, I mean, these are, there's a lot of pop culture things that stuck around from this film, even if it's pop culture has considered the lesser of the three. But I think it probably maybe has the most long-standing impact on pop culture. I'd say. Now, I thought this was interesting. George Miller had planned to bring Mad Max to the small screen after this and started developing a TV show based off the movies. And he wanted John Blake, who he had worked with on Cool Change, to star in the series as Mad Max. But John Blake, his career came to a premature end when he sustained permanent brain damage in an auto accident. So that ended the potential Mad Max TV show that George Miller was working on. And then the franchise kind of sat in stasis for a long time. We'll talk about when it comes back in Mad Max Fury Road.
Excellent. Awesome. Hey, that's some good trivia, buddy. So, my first experience with this film was on television. You know, I remember seeing it one night when I was a kid in Saskatoon. So it was probably around 1986, 87. I would have been 5 or 6 years old. And I remember seeing it on TV, and, you know, this was my introduction to the Mad Max franchise at a young age. And so I don't know when I ended up getting around to the other ones, but this is kind of a staple film of my youth, I remember. So when were you exposed to this one?
Yeah, same thing. I saw it on cable, I think. You know, probably I think one of the first things I saw was the Thunderdome parts. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, what is this? You know, probably my dad told me about it, I think. And then that's why I kind of eventually saw the whole film and then saw second film, and then as we discovered together, never saw the first film. It's interesting that it's called Beyond Thunderdome, and you think, yeah, Thunderdome, that's like the thing, right? And the film does go beyond Thunderdome, because Thunderdome was like gone after like the beginning 45 minutes.
Beyond.
And I don't know, like I that's, to me, that's the highlight of the film, that entire thing. And I wish there had been more of that. Like, I wish you had a rematch with someone in the Thunderdome, you know. Okay. And I mean, I guess maybe it's a one trick thing. Would have been boring to see the same fight again. I don't know, but I just think that was such a huge selling point and what this film was known for. And then after halfway through, it's not even a factor anymore, you know.
Well, what if the kids were in there fighting to the death?
Sure. Whether then it would be PG-13.
No, I guess not. So this movie's weird. Like, I love this movie, and I love both plot lines in this movie. I think both plot lines are really fantastic. However, this new movie is not greater than the sum of its two parts. I think having such tonally different parts of the film together detract from the whole. What do you think?
Yeah, because, I mean, I would say the first half is like a 5 out of 5. Like, I loved what they were doing in the first half of the film. And then it becomes, like I said, Hook in the second half. And you can kind of see where they had their idea for that film. And they're like, well, let's add Mad Max to it. And then that was the first half. And then they didn't really, because he just, okay, Gulag is a prison, I thought, right?
Yeah, a Russian prison.
So he spins the wheel to go to the Gulag. And then it's like, no, it's not Gulag. It's exile, because they just send him out in the desert to die on a horse, right? So that's not a Gulag. But then he just like passes out, and then these kids find him, and then it's a whole nother plot for like, that's the weakest area for like, I don't know, like a good 20 minutes when like the kids are getting him back to health and they're telling him the story and showing him slides of the world.
Oh, really? Oh, I love
that
stuff.
Okay.
So I do. I really love that plot line, because it's so interesting, because it makes me want to know like who this Walker is. Who's this guy Walker?
Did they draw that before they saw Mad Max?
Yes, I think they did.
Okay.
And that's the impression that I get.
Okay.
So, and that's why she was cutting his hair, right? So that's why they were making him look good and cut his hair and whatnot, because they could see the gray hair underneath and whatnot. So it's like, what happened here? Like, what caused these kids to be left here? You know, why did they end up there? I mean, like, the kids have been there for a while, and there's some young kids there. So, I mean, like, have they left recently? Because if you said 20 months, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's no adults there. So are these kids having kids and whatnot? Mm-hmm. Like, how would they survive that?
Right.
You know, so I don't know. Like, I think it's a really interesting idea of what's going on. I love this idea of this oasis, like trapped in the desert where these kids are surviving.
You like,
and
you like the
and
possibilities that it creates and where your imagination goes with it. Okay.
The world building. Yeah. And the idea that like they've got this technology, but they don't have it quite right. Like the words and whatnot, because they haven't had an adult there to teach them, right? Like the high scrapers, and you know, he's got the record, and I love the moment when they realize the record can go on the record player in the train. I don't know. I really love that moment, you know, and how it's just like this educational, like this learning French record, right? How to learn French and whatnot. There's just a lot of really cool stuff where they took what they have and make something out of it. And telling the story with the pictures projected and whatnot, and the viewfinder and whatnot is really neat. Mm-hmm. But again, it's on its own, it's wonderful.
Yeah.
Thunderdome on its own is wonderful, but together they take away each other. It's weird having them meet up at the end and having the kids kind of be part of the heroes at the end, you know?
Yeah, well, I guess that's where it hinges. That's where it like turns the next story. And that's why I was like, oh, I didn't. That's why I kind of focused it on that point for the trend. I see, yeah. In isolation, if a Mad Max movie started out that way.
Yeah.
I'd be like, okay, I see what we're doing. But it's like, no, I want to go back to Thunderdome and Tina Turner and all those guys, you know. Why are we spending time here? And then it was the whole motivation at the end of, like, they rescued the little guy, right?
Master.
Yeah.
Well,
why?
Because, like, yeah, when you're watching this film, it's like, when we start watching the film, I realize that we're not given all the information and whatnot, and we realize that, you know, Anti-Entity is kind of like manipulating the situation. At the end of the day, Master Blaster's still a dick, and he's still like, on a whim, he'll shut this town down just because he feels like it and wants them to just say he's powerful, right? So, like, he's still not, I still don't get the impression that he's a good character. And so for him to be good at the end feels tonally weird from the character that we've been
involved
with.
Yeah, they dress him up in a little 3-piece suit and a bowler hat, and they're going to save him. Like, where did this come from? It just felt very odd. I know she wanted him back to kind of run the stuff because he knew about it. But other than that, it was just odd. I don't know. I didn't care for that turn. And as you said, like, they're so involved in the rescuing and all that at the end. And it is a bit of a rehash of, you know, I guess they're all car chases, right? But like, here's a big giant vehicle being chased by all these other little vehicles around. So a little bit of a rehash of the last film at the end, but you know, but with the train. So at least it's not an 18-wheeler. So there's that. Now let's talk about the Thunderdome stuff though with Master Blaster. Like this is the thing that like blew my mind as a kid, right? And always stuck with me. We're like, you know, it's this big, you know, it's like Lord Humongous again, right? A big guy with a mask, you don't see his face. And it's like every film in this franchise is like finding elements and like switching them around and improving them for the next film in a way, right? So like you have Mad Max fighting this guy, he's been built up as this big monster, Darth Vader kind of guy, right? And then, but they establish, again, set up from payoff, they establish the whistle and the noise that kind of messes with his head. So you know that's going to come into play. And I think that's so clever, like, during because the Thunderdome fight is awesome. But then and on top of that, like, you know he has to get that whistle and he loses it. And you're like, oh, God, you got to hold on to the whistle. So that was really, and he sees it and it's, like, shining in the light. And anyway, that was a really cool suspension of suspense there. So then, like, you know, as you said, the information we get is like they're the bad guys, right? And you know, Max doesn't know. He shows up and he's like, okay, I guess this is what we're doing. I want my stuff back. And you know, so then you know he hits the helmet off and he sees it's like young kid with Down syndrome, you know. And then he can't do it, you know. And so I think that really shows like his humanity despite everything he's been through. I think that's a real powerful thing. And because you're like, wow, like that's some dark stuff, right? And then everybody's mad that he doesn't kill him. And to me, that really elevates what was already an amazing set piece and action sequence to me, that being the resolution of it. And then him saying, no, like, I want my stuff back, but I'm not going to murder this innocent person who doesn't know any better, really.
Right. He doesn't know what's going on. But I mean, like, that's the thing too. So yeah, so the Auntie ends up killing him, getting Blaster killed. But I mean, even with Master at the end of it, like, this is like the teacher on the baseball team from RoboCop 2, right? Where it's like just, you know, he's got these kids, like, he's got these kids that don't know any better, that he's convinced to start stealing a bunch of stuff from electronics
stores.
He's
the one having people snap people's necks and stuff. He's the real villain.
He's
here.
The one, Master's controlling Blaster doing this. And then at the end of the day, we'd be like, hey, Mr. Baseball Coach, that's okay. You're actually a really good guy, and we're going to rescue you and save you. It's like, what? You know, like, yeah, I get that Master loves Blaster. Maybe blasters his son or his grandson or something like that.
Maybe.
Like maybe something like that. And I get that they're just together because they're opposites. You know, big, strong, and slow versus short and smart, right? Like the two fit together kind of that way. So maybe it's just that, two people getting together and having some type of bond because of their own disabilities. But it's like, Master's still a dick.
Yeah. That I get they wanted to take him away because Tina Turner wanted to keep him, right? I'm like, okay, that's why you want to take him away, but like, don't like treat him like your buddy.
Yeah.
So it was that. I don't know how they came to that conclusion. So that was odd, but yeah,
that feels tonally very strange. It really does. But let me ask you this question here about the pacing of the film and the order of it. What if they rewrote this? They gave this one more draft, and they switched the first two acts. Like, what if the kids just come across Max in the desert? They rescue him. They think of who he is. And then he rescues the kids and takes them because he knows that there's this fabled Bartertown city. And the kids come with him. And then the stuff in Bartertown happens. And then we get the climax. There's obviously some more rewriting that needs to be done as to, like, what happens with the kids while they get to Bartertown and whatnot. That would make it a different. But what would you... I think that the structure of the film, I think that would improve it significantly if the first two acts were switched in some kind of way.
Yeah, that would make it feel more organic, for sure. Instead of just so separated. And it is odd because, I mean, it's 15 years after the last film, which we don't really know that. We just know that from, like, outside the movie telling us that. Like, so I'm like, well, how did Max end up with all these camels in the, like, I'm like, I don't know who's, and then on the first watch, you're confused that, like, wait, is that the same gyro captain? Does he know Max? Like, why is he acting this way? Like, are they going to meet and have some kind of reconciliation or discussion? And like, no, it's a different guy. So all you take all that baggage out of there. And I think if you just start out with, like, them finding him, who knows what his last adventure was, and I think that's a better way to start. I agree. And keep them around the whole time, and then they go back because the kids get enslaved there or something, right? Who knows, right? But I think that would be a better structure, as you said.
Yeah, even there, the kids start having to shovel the pig crap, right? And so Max is going to rescue them or something like that. I don't know. So it has tones too. It's of it makes me think of what's the Temple of Doom a little bit too, right? That sequence in the
Indiana Jones
area.
And the Temple of Doom. Yeah. Did you know, Brandon, that is a prequel to Raiders of the Lost Ark?
I did know
okay,
that.
Okay. That's
mention
cool.
That.
Not a lot of people know that. So I just want to make sure. No, I also thought about that too, because I was like, wait, do the kids end up working down here, or was that Temple of Doom? Yeah. And is Mad Max going to show up and like stand in a doorway and punch a big guy out and lead them all to freedom? So, no, but that was a year before this. So that would have been not influencing this, because this would have been in production by the time that came out. So that's similar release times, but not the overlapping. So it's not like they saw Temple of Doom. It's like, oh, I know what we need kids, right? Because that is, you know, when franchises start to like run out of ideas or try to like appeal to a wider audience, they kind of lighten it up or add kids or stuff like that, right?
Or go to space.
Jason X. Yeah.
Mad Max in space. I mean, it doesn't quite work. I mean, I guess he could find a rocket ship.
Brandon, like you know how much fuel it takes to get into space? There's no way they have that much fuel left in the world.
What if at the end of this movie, an atomic bomb went off, right? And we think everybody's dead, but at the end, it's really actually Master and Max have been shot off into space, and then they go back in time.
They wake up in modern day for the next film.
That'd be interesting.
Yeah. And there's a... this whole discussion is just referencing other films that most of which we've talked about already.
Already on this, yes, absolutely. So
this is what this is going to become, just referencing ourselves and other movies. But no, I guess it the kids themselves are not the problem. It's the way they're inserted into the movie is the problem.
That's right.
Like, roll my eyes like, oh, kids. It's like, oh, okay, well, this is a different story than we had for the first hour. Because I'll say this for Tina Turner, right? I think she's one of the best villains in here, because I like her backstory. Like, it's very brief, but she's like, I was nobody, now I'm somebody, and you were somebody, now you're nobody, you know? And that's how it would work with the apocalypse and stuff. And also, she actually has interactions with Max, unlike all the other villains in this franchise. You know what I mean? Like, he doesn't interact with these people outside of car chases. And so I thought she had more character interplay with him than anybody else villain-wise, you know?
Right. And they're articulate with each other. Like there's a whole setup of stuff going on in Bartertown. Like all these people are involved. Like the guy with the head on the back of his head, right? Like
yeah.
Like that weird thing. Like it's neat because that really fits within the universe, uh-huh. right? For the elaborate costumes. But then there's the guy who takes the weapons. Like when he takes Max to go see her, and they're explaining this whole thing of like, look, we've got this internal problem that we can't deal with. We don't have anybody here to deal with. But you as an external can come in, fight this guy, and help us get rid of this problem that we have. Like that is amazing stuff. That is really wonderful stuff. And the way that that's dealt with, the way that they like, you know, they test him, right? They got to test to see whether or not he can do this. And then they do like the hand clap for the deal. They spit on the hands and do the deal. Yeah, like, I don't know. I just love
it's like
this
an
stuff.
Understood post-apocalyptic thing, I guess, the spitting on the hands and the handshake. But
yeah, because spit is thicker than blood, I guess, or something like that. So, but I don't know. Like there's some really fantastic stuff in there. I don't know. Like it just kind of falls apart. So then we get this weird ending, right? Where this train out of nowhere is in the basement of this barter town, right?
With, and they with just that take one off. Guy, Pig Killer, carved on his chest. He's like helping him out for some reason. He's the one that gives Max's monkey the water to go find Max. Okay.
Because, I don't know, Max was nice to him, I guess, underneath there. So like, all it takes is a little kindness,
that's
buddy.
Right.
All it takes is
you
a little kindness.
You never know. Be nice to everybody. You never know. Pay it forward.
You never know who being kind to will end up with, you know, some monkey coming and bringing you water and saving your life.
You,
right?
You never know when you're going to need a monkey to bring you water. So just be nice to everybody. But
the monkey's the real hero.
See, a dog couldn't have carried that water.
No.
The only
dog would have drank the water.
Dog would have drank the water. But yeah, the train, was that established at all until it showed up?
I don't think so. Like I, every time I watch the film, I'm surprised by this train. Like, I know that there's a chase sequence at the end, but I think I always forget that it's on a train, you know? And then it's kind of weird because it's like, it's on a train. Well, a train is only a defined area, right? Like, it's just, it can only go to a specific place, and that's along
it's
the
like,
train
why
tracks.
Why is there train tracks in the middle of the desert here? Who knows? I guess it was left over from the time before or whatever, right? That's what we'll say, right?
The time before.
You're watching, and you're like, I guess there's going to be a car chase at some point because it's Mad Max movie, and so that becomes your car chase. But, I mean, I don't know. I still like the physical confrontations between heroes and villains, one-on-one combat, sword fights, you know, all that stuff. I love that, and that's something that the other films have been lacking. So I really liked when we got that with Thunderdome, and I thought, okay, maybe we'll get that again. Like, maybe Tina Turner will fight Mad Max in the Thunderdome. Like, maybe that would be unmatched. I don't know, but I would have liked another one like that at the end. Because of all the movies, even, you know, looking ahead to Fury Road, you don't get that like as like the big climax or anything. It's always cars and chasing. And maybe that's what this franchise is. You know, maybe I shouldn't expect some like hand-to-hand combat. When for a movie that's called Thunderdome in the title and there's a Thunderdome in it and there's a big fight, like I would want another, because usually there's like a, it's like the Rocky movies, right? You have one fight and then you have your bigger fight at the end, right? And it's like, that's kind of what I was maybe looking for in a movie with, which has a fight ring in the title. Right. It's their fault for making Thunderdome so cool that I wanted to see more of it.
But like the chase sequence at the end, like it pales in comparison to the last film, you know, like, and even at the last film, we got the twist of Max not knowing that the gas was inside the was not inside the tank. Right. So like there was like even a twist there that added a layer to the chase and changed your perception of it. But even here, it's not that. It's just the train stops and then they got to like, even though they had like all this, they were like right there with them the whole time. Now all of a sudden there's a whole bunch of space between them and they're like really far away and they got all this extra time to get the plane up and running. And I don't know. It just kind of takes away from it for me a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that the plane sequence was needed. You know, like we get this interesting finale of them going over the apocalypse.
That was interesting. Right? Yeah, seeing the opera house and Sydney and all that stuff. And like, okay.
But that's for, I think that's more for us as the viewers than like anybody in the film, you know?
That's true. That's a good point. Yeah, because Max is not there anymore. These kids have no concept of what the world was, and they're here they are in the, and I guess Bruce Spence's character will again be the leader of a group of people who started a new society. Yeah.
I guess with the kids though, like they probably asked him and said, take us to a city because they had the pictures. So maybe it's some kind of closure for the kids and realizing that the world that they've been hoping will come to rescue them will never come.
Mm-hmm.
So, But yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure. So I don't know that that sequence is really necessary or not. So some really great stuff in this film. It's not as good as the sum of its parts. And there's some things that I wish they would change. But I still love it. It's still a lot of fun. And I will not hesitate to watch this movie. I love this movie, even though it's, you know, it's not a five-star film like the last one.
It's very rewatchable. And I guess, you know, having watched the third one first, Brandon, I guess you weren't, the whole Gyro Captain Bruce Spence character confusion wasn't even a thing for you.
Wasn't even there.
So that's helpful.
By the time I saw the second one, I don't think I realized, you know, because it had been a while. So it wasn't until later when I'm like, wait a minute, that's the guy from the second one.
Well, and then this franchise does that, right? Like Toe Cutter becomes Immortan Joe, right, in the fourth one, right? But it's not as obvious because he's a totally different character. You don't see his face. It's like the thing is he has the same job doing the same thing. And it's just odd. And they wrote the whole airplane thing in, sure, but you didn't need to bring back that. Sure, have this character. Don't bring me that actor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Weren't there more kids? Aren't there like 60 kids or something? Did he take mini trips out to the... Did they stop by the Oasis?
They fit them all. I don't know. They fit them all in the plane. All the
That's
ones
not
that
a 747. So. That's like a two-seater plane. So tiny, in my headcanon, he just took, you know, about 8 or 9 round trips out to that Oasis back to Sydney. And that's how they got the entire tribe out there. So...
Did they leave him, or did they just go back to the Oasis and leave him there? Because they were living just fine there.
But they were in the city at the end, telling the story. You know, the girl had a baby, so some time had passed.
Oh, you're right. So, you're right. Got to tell the tellings. Got to tell the tellings. Yeah, so it's good. It's a good movie.
Well, Brandon, I have a question for you.
Oh, do you?
Out of 5 levels of madness, how mad did Mad Max Beyond the Thunderdome make you?
Well, if we were talking about the first hour, I would say 5. Mm-hmm. But we're not talking about the first hour. We're talking about the whole thing. So I'm going to say that this gave me 3. This made me 3 times mad. What do you think?
Okay. Okay. I was going to say 4 out of 5 levels of madness for me. Because it's just it's a very enjoyable, very rewatchable, you know?
Yeah.
Like, and that's what I've meant by at the beginning. People say, it's the worst of the 3. I don't know. Like, I would watch, for me, this is way more enjoyable and rewatchable than the first film.
Okay. Yeah, see, it's tough. They're kind of close, but I think I prefer the first one just because it's like it's got like a quieter tone to it. Like, you know, there's that long build up of getting Max onto screen and seeing him for the first time. You know, you got that really interesting sequence at the end where he's like chasing everybody down. You know, we got the car chase, which I really appreciate. And I think that the train sequence on here is a pale comparison of what we saw in the last film. So I would definitely put the first Mad Max over this one here. So yeah, I would give this a 3. I really enjoy it. But yeah.
This one is more polished. Obviously, it has a bigger budget, right? Yeah. Time has passed, so you know it has that going for it. But there's an argument to be made that any of these, you know, that I just think it's good that there's not an obvious like, well, that's obviously the worst one of this franchise. So that's something to say, because a lot of these franchises we do where it's like, okay, well, this is obviously the terrible one, and if this is the bad one, quote unquote, right, then that's pretty good. So
what did you do? You remember what you rated the first Mad Max?
3.5.
See, like, I would give this, if I was doing halves, I'd give it a 3.5,
okay.
Right?
All right.
I would give it a 3.5. Like, but I can't give it a 4. I just can't quite give
these
it a 4.
These are the rules, Brandon. These are the rules. You break the law, you get the wheel. Or break a deal,
break
get the
wheel.
Deals.
Break the deal, face the wheel.
Face the wheel.
And I don't want to be facing no gulag, right? Either version, whether it's just the Russian thing or whether it's the big head.
I like how they put that, like, Pinocchio head on him and just, that's such a... great post-apocalyptic,
so ridiculous,
thing.
Yeah. That fits so much in this universe. I love it. It is great.
All right, so. Well, 3 out of 5 for you, and 4 out of 5 for me, for Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. But Brandon, I have another question for you.
Oh, do you?
How many car crashes were in this film?
So there's a couple at the end. I don't know, like 4 or 5, I would say. Not quite many.
Yeah, so here's what I came up with. We had... first one was when the henchman's car got hit by the train, right, head on, right. The second is the henchman's car that kind of flew off when they got to the bridge, and then there was the head on collision between Mad Max and the other car. So that's 3 and 4, and I thought there were a couple more in there, like cars flying around, you know. So with that in mind, right, because there was some collateral damage beyond that head-on collision, right? So with that in mind, that would bring us to 6 for this film, which brings us to a franchise total to this point of 38 car crashes.
Okay, excellent. Well, I got a question for you.
Oh, what's that?
Is this franchise fatigued?
I would say no, because the last film had a similar, like, and then Mad Max wandered off and we never saw him again ending, and then we saw him again in this film. Also, you don't, outside of what George Miller and other sources from outside the film tell us, we don't know this took 15 years after the first one, so we don't know how much time has passed. There's so many experiences. Again, like we've been saying, he's a man with no name character. He can wander in and out of any situation. And that's what I, another strong point to me about this film is it's not the same exact thing. I mean, there's the chase scene at the end, but like, it's not the same exact thing as the first two, right? It's a whole other set of circumstances. So I would like to continue to see him wander through the endless possibilities of the post-apocalypse. So that's a no for me.
I would agree. I'd definitely say no. And I know that because they were talking about a Mad Max 4 for a long time. And I was excited for a Mad Max 4 since whatever film magazine I read that talked about stuff being produced right next to, you know, Planet of the Apes with Arnold Schwarzenegger was Mad Max 4, right? They were talking about these things being in a production for a long time. Like in the early to mid 90s, these things were being discussed. And I was always looking forward to another one. So yeah, I would say definitely not. I'd love to see more in this franchise, and I'm grateful that we got one, even as long as it took to get four. I'm grateful for it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's all we got for you today on this discussion. We'll be back next time to discuss Mad Max Fury Road. Thank you so much to Zach Tripp for creating our wonderful theme music. Thank you to Ken Tripp and Tony Robinson for being executive producers of the network. And thank you to Tony Robinson for creating our show art. You can find the show on Twitter at Franchise Fatigue. You can find the network on Twitter at UFP Earth on Twitter. You can send us an email, franchisefatigue@ufp.earth. As for me, you can find me here on the network with another show called Infinite Diversity, which is all about new Star Trek. And you can find me over on the Fandom Podcast Network, as well as in our own independent feed with a show called Good Evening and Alfred Hitchcock Podcast. Now, Zach, where can people find you when you're not trying to challenge somebody and get them into a Thunderdome for a to-the-death battle?
Well, you can find me personally on Twitter at MoronZach. That's MoreLNZach. I'm also the host of my own podcast, Always Alone with Smallville, where we talk about each and every episode of that Young Superman show. You can find us on Twitter at AlwaysSmallville with 1S. I'm also hosting Sasquatch, a Bigfoot multimedia podcast with Ken Tripp here on the network. And you can find us on Twitter at SasquatchPod. We talk about the cultural phenomenon of Bigfoot and have a good time with stuff over there.
Excellent. Right on. Well, if you want to support us on the network for $5 a month, you get a monthly commentary with Zach and I, where we do a Star Trek episode. And for $10 a month, you can become an associate producer of a show of your choice. And we have two associate producers here on this show. We have Casey Pettit and David Willett. Thank you guys so much for your support of the network and our show in particular. We appreciate it. Till next time, guys. Mad Max Fury Road. But you better join us, because if you don't, break the deal. Face the wheel.
Break the deal, face the wheel.
This has been a production of MTMR Media Works.